accession number 17583, reel 1.
Major Dairy 1, where were you born, please?
In Cranleigh, Surrey.
Which year was this?
1922.
Did you grow up and have your initial schooling in Cranleigh?
No, I was actually educated at Guildford.
Whereabouts?
In the Royal Grammar School. I left there in July 1939. I was then actually 16 years old, but I got away with 17. I was called from the what then existed Emergency Reserve of Army Officers, which was basically a register of people who held Certificate A or Part 1 of Certificate B, in the old Officer Training Corps. And I was called up to the Oxford University Reception Unit, I do remember the date, 26th of September 1939, and I was enrolled then as a potential officer cadet for commission training. I was posted immediately to the Ox and Bucks Light Infantry for administrative purposes, then went down to the Buffs Depot in Canterbury for about 3 months, pending departure for India. It was always intended I would go into the Indian Army.
Had your father been a professional soldier?
My father was not a professional soldier, but he became a member of the Sussex Regiment, Royal Sussex Regiment, just before the 1914-18 war started. He went to India. He served in India until he had to come home wounded after what must have been the Third Afghan War, which finished about 1921-1922. During that period, he was, in fact, attached for a short time to the 4th Gurkha Rifles.
Hence your own wish to go into the Indian Army?
Yes, I always wanted to go to the Indian Army. Originally, it had been intended that I would go into the Navy. In those days, you went in via Dartmouth at the age of about 13. And at that stage in the game, Dartmouth was the most expensive public school in the country, and no way could my parents afford it. As the time I went was immediately, was really slap in the middle of the terrible 1930 slump.
What had been your attitude to the news of Chamberlain's declaration of war against Germany?
I don't think it was one of any great shock or surprise. The one forgets now, but you've got to remember that the key parties of the Territorial Army and Reserve Forces had all been called up in August 1938. And those key parties, in many cases, had not been stood down. I had friends of my own who were territorials in the local Queen's unit who had been in camp since August 38. I seem to remember that the Territorial Army as such was stood too in August 1939. So when the actual declaration of war came, I don't think it caused a great deal of shock or excitement's the wrong word. Obviously people were pretty shattered by it, but we were prepared for it mentally. Certainly we weren't prepared for it as regards armaments and equipment and probably training, but mentally we were prepared and expecting it to happen. So in retrospect, you could say that it caused far, far less disturbance to this country, the declaration of a new world war, than the recent tragic death of Princess Diana caused.
So you are up to being in transit to India. This is spring 1940.
Yeah.
If you can take it from there, please.
Right, well, we sailed under pretty appalling conditions. We left this country under the aegis of the British Army and were treated virtually as private soldiers. There's nothing wrong with that, but the troopship conditions were very tough indeed. But halfway to India at the Cape, we became gentlemen cadets. They still had gentlemen cadets in those days, not officer cadets, of the Indian Army. And we had very comfortable liner passages to Bombay. Arrived in Bombay, if I remember right, at the back end of February 1940. From there, we went down by train to Bangalore in southern India, where a cadet college had been established. There was an officer training school at Belgaum. An officer training school already existed, regular Indian one, in Dehradun, and a wartime one was started in Bangalore. And I think I'm right in saying we were the second course. As we were trained up to Certificate B, or Part 1 of Certificate B standard, we were probably more au fait with some of the more modern small arms weapons than the instructors. So really, our period at Bangalore was a period of indoctrination into the Indian Army rather than a training period. And for that reason, it was a very short period. I think that the run-of-the-mill cadets did about 4 to 6 months, and my memory is that we only did about 2 months there. And in addition, we'd had an advantage, or I certainly had a big personal advantage, in that travelling out from England to India with us were a number of senior Indian Army officers being recalled from leave. And one of them, Colonel Elliot, who was the son of a chap who I think had been ADC to the governor of Bengal, obviously took a... We got on rather well. And he said to me about 3 days out from the UK that if I was prepared to work, I would be able to speak Hindustani or Urdu by the time we reached India. And the old chap was perfectly correct. I was able to pass my obligatory Urdu exam within about a fortnight of reaching India.
Did the Indian population itself seem to be at all excited about the war having broken out in Europe?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that it had... India carried on... largely as they had done in peacetime. We clearly had the problems on the frontier as regards the army, and the nucleus of some of the crack regiments of the Indian Army, of course, were moving out to the desert, to the Middle East, where they virtually bore the brunt of the war, the early part of the war.
What did you feel about the quality of the course that you had at the college at Bangalore?
Very difficult at this distance in time. I think basically it was a jolly good course. It catered for what we needed to learn rather than going back over what we really were pretty well au fait with. You would remember the officer training corps before the war in all the schools was a very efficient force, and people who joined it were very keen, very dedicated people. And it did indeed provide an immediate supply of officers to cover the enormous expansion of both the British Army and the Indian Army. The expansion of the Indian Army was something which is very difficult for anybody to realise the extent to which it was expanded, particularly as, unlike British regiments, we had a tiny handful of officers. I don't know what the establishments are today, but I believe in 1939, 1940 in India, a British regiment had a strength of something like 50 officers, whereas an Indian regiment had a total of 11. This, of course, discounts the old Viceroy's commissioned officers, the Jemadars and Subedars, who filled a tremendous part of that gap. But it still did not equate. We were very, very short of officers.
And the next step?
Sorry?
The next step for you?
The next step, I was commissioned into the 4th Prince of Wales Own Gurkha Rifles and was posted direct after 7 days joining leave to the 1st Battalion, senior battalion of the regiment, which was then coming down off the frontier. I do recollect I, after about a 3-day train journey, I joined the battalion in Umballa, and I joined on a Thursday morning, was wheeled into the adjutant and the CO just before lunch, and that afternoon I took command as a second lieutenant with roughly 6 or 7 days commission service. I took command of D Company, regular company, rifle company, a company which I commanded, in fact, until wounds and other things caused me finally to leave the battalion many years later.
What was the composition of D Company?
Oh, D Company, the company strength then, it was a rifle company. Company strength then was about 150, 156 men, divided into 3 rifle platoons, each of 3 sections, and a company headquarters with signalers and buglers and things like that.
Where did the Gurkhas come from in this company?
The 4th Gurkhas were, they all obviously come from Nepal. The 4th Gurkhas were specifically a Western regiment. The old Gurkha Brigade consisted of 10 regiments. 7 of them were Mugger Gurung, or predominantly Mugger Gurung regiments, and the men were predominantly from Western Nepal. The 7th and 10th were Rai Limbu regiments. The men came from Eastern Nepal, and their recruiting base, the Eastern Nepal recruiting base, was Darjeeling. And the regimental centres were in Eastern India, in Assam, whereas the Western regiments, the centres were all really in northwest India, and the recruiting centre was Kundragat. In those days, no British officer was allowed to enter Nepal. The recruits came down to the border and enlisted, crossed the border themselves, brought down by Gurkha serving soldiers who were bringing them down to join the British Army, known as Gullawallas, recruiters. And they got a small reward for each recruit they brought in who was accepted. And very high physical standards were demanded. But later, as the war proceeded, more and more men came down, and there were areas in heavily recruited areas in Western Nepal in particular, where there were practically no able-bodied young men left in big areas of the land.
So was it possible to tell the difference between a Mugger and a Gurung?
No, the answer is no, not. It might be if they do have, we all spoke what was known variably as Gurkhali or Kaskura, a central language throughout the brigade, whereas all the different Jats, all the different tribes, had their own languages. Kaskura was best translated as Pakakura, as a proper language or a central language, whereas Muggakura or Gurungkura would be the language of the Gurung or Mugger castes. Rai Limbu the same. I forget how many different dialects or languages there are, but they do really vary. I mean, I think in the language which we all spoke throughout the brigade, to ask a chap what his name was, you would probably say Terunam Kirtsa. As if you were speaking that same phrase, Terunam Kirtsa, in Gurungkura, you would say Nakunga Minhiale. There's very little relationship. The men themselves had to learn to speak a language. And in those days, They probably hadn't seen a wheel until they came down from the high goat, from the high hills. And certainly when the recruits first came in, it's not so nowadays, but when they first came in, the recruits spent the first few days of their recruit service taking off their, or putting on their uniform, taking it off again, until they were used to doing it. And it was not unusual to find a new recruit wandering around with his boots on wrong feet and things like that. It's amazing people that they picked up sophisticated training, unable to read or write, and within 4 months, 5 months, they had become surprisingly efficient soldiers. And that's, they started, of course, with a very highly professional force. When I joined the 1st Battalion, I shouldn't think there was a Lance Knight, that's a Lance Corporal, with less than 6 or 7 years service.
What impression did the Gurkha troops make on you at first?
Not an impression, much more than an impression. I thought that they were unbelievably wonderful people. I served with them for many years. I still have the privilege of visiting India pretty frequently. I've just been out recently to Staff College. And they haven't changed. There may be soldiers as good as the Gurkha, but there are no better soldiers in the world. And I think never had nation more faithful friends than these sums it all up.
What especially were their soldierly qualities?
Kapuhunam Bandamana Ramra. It is better to be dead than a coward. I think that is the prime one. The second is tremendous allegiance. They will never let anybody down. I have known them in certain circumstances where it got almost beyond the Gurkha to go again, but they always went. They've suffered terrible casualties. Nobody is fearless, but they are far less fearless than most people I've bumped into. The discipline is absolutely first class, without any need for rigorous control. All my service, I never recollect any serious problems anywhere with discipline. I'm perhaps subsequently more recent years with more contact with sophisticated Western life, I would probably be looked upon as pipe dreaming a little bit, but it was certainly so through all my time.
Did they have any weaknesses as soldiers?
Weaknesses? Well, obviously everybody must have weaknesses, but no, I really can't pinpoint anything that one could, with a wide stroke of the brush, to say had they got weaknesses. I certainly never saw any weakness of discipline, and it's self-discipline too. It wasn't a discipline that was imposed rigorously. They're extremely smart soldiers. Certainly in my time, absolutely honest. I mean, you did have your minor disciplinary problems, having said you didn't, but I mean, obviously you have occasions where something arises, and you have a chap in on charge and ask him what happened, and you'd get some absolutely cock and bull story which nobody could believe, and you'd say, "Is that really, sir?" And the rifleman would say, "No, sir, but it's not. I'll tell you the true story now." And I had that happen more than once.
So why did they give you the initial version then?
I suppose it's self-defense, and it's probably they're rather ashamed of what's happened. They're not too anxious to commit themselves, I suppose.
What do you think their attitude towards you was? when you first arrived?
I think that the attitude to oligarchies, to their British officers, was that if the British officer was clearly making every effort to do his job and to communicate with the men, he had 100% backing, and in spite of perhaps language difficulties, there never seemed any problem in the Gurkha understanding what was required. If the officer showed the least cowardice or took the attitude that he wasn't going to learn some outlandish language, then he didn't last very long. The Gurkha had absolutely no time for him. But given the fact that chap was, however inefficient, if he was trying to make the best possible fist of it, he would be backed up 100% by his men.
What do you think the Gurkha's motivation was for serving loyally? Was there any attachment to the crown? Was there any attachment to Britain? Was there any attachment to the empire? Or was it just a regimental loyalty? Or what exactly was there, the thing that drove?
Well, I think that it's two things. It is mutual respect between our two races and great loyalty to the tradition of the regiment. If we go back to the start of the Brigade of Gurkhas, or Gurkha Brigade as it was then, you will, I'm sure, be aware from your history that this started after a shocking great battle we had at Malone Fort up on the Nepal border. Gosh, I ought to know the dates, but round about 1800, or a little earlier than that even, perhaps 1840, when, after a tremendous battle which went on for weeks, the Gurkha defending force, out of supplies, had to surrender to superior British forces, and the British forces had been, chivalry existed in those days, had been so impressed by the conduct of the Gurkhas through this dreadful battle that they allowed them to march out to the surrender with flags flying and carrying their arms, which was pretty unprecedented. And when the surrender was complete, in his turn, the Gurkhas turned round and said, look, chaps that fight like you British, we ought not to be fighting each other, we ought to join together, we'd like to sign up for you. And that was the start of the Brigade of Gurkhas. I'm sure you've heard the story before. And that, I think, carried on from there.
Now, if we can pick up the chronology again, you've just arrived at Ambala and been given your duty. Can you take me further into the story, please?
Well, the following day, having taken over this company, the following day, I was warned that I had to take them out on a... I can't remember what it was about, but it was virtually about a three-week patrol along the Patiala border. Again, at this distance in time, I can't think what it was about, but I was out with the company on my own. I was going to be out with the company on my own for 3 weeks. And it was casually mentioned that the syce, the groom, would bring down my charger at 4 o'clock in the morning. Perhaps I should mention then that company commanders in the Indian Army and the adjutant CO, which second in command, were all mounted. When I was told that my charger would be brought down in the morning, you've got to remember I was 19 years old, I'd been pitchforked into a regular battalion. I think that there was only one other wartime officer there who was an older chap than I was, up next salon planter. And I didn't ride a horse. And I was too shy to say, well, I've never been on a horse, I think I have to walk. I went back to my quarters in the mess, And I got hold of the bearer who'd been assigned to me, and I shot him off to find the Dursey, the regimental tailor, so I could have a pair of, I'd only got shorts and service dress, to have a pair of what are called in this country jodhpurs, which I think in India we would have called jodhpurs, made for me, ready for the following morning. So between about tea time and midnight, I had a pair of jodhpurs or jodhpurs made. And the syce came down in the morning with the horse. I succeeded in getting on it without too much embarrassment to everybody. And off we went. Common sense told me how to steer it. I managed fairly well. And if we had to go quicker than a walk, I had to... I was reduced to really dropping the reins and holding the pommel of the saddle. And we managed like that for 3 weeks, at the end of which time I was in fact able to canter. It was a quick way to learn, but I'd never been through an equitation school. But by watching the syce, I managed fairly well. The only problem was, I do recollect that the Dursey, the tailor who'd made up my jodhpurs out of heavy khaki drill, had not had time to shrink the cloth, and they fitted fairly well when I started out, but after I'd been wet and dry once or twice, they became rather painful as they tightened up round important parts.
What happened on the patrol?
Sorry?
What happened on the patrol?
I think, I honestly, there was no action of any sort. I do not remember now what it was about. I know it was a lengthy one, and it went right round this border. There were pipelines of various sorts there, and I can't remember what they were about. I may have been pipelines coming down from the Attock oil fields. But I really can't remember it. The only thing I can think of is that it must have been some form of internal security exercise. Certainly there was no shooting and no enemy visible.
Was India in a peaceful condition?
Oh, very much so, yes.
What are your next memories?
I went off to the small arms school at Sorgho, which basically, because the Bren gun had arrived in India, until that time the Indian Army was equipped with a light automatic called a Vickers Berthier, which became obsolete with the arrival of the Bren gun. And the usual thing happened, we handed in our Vickers Berthiers because they were obsolete, but it was months and months before they were replaced with Bren guns. So for a long time we had neither. But I was recalled from that small arms course because the battalion was mobilizing and moving down to Secunderabad. We moved down to Secunderabad and we formed 19 Div in Secunderabad under the command of a famous Victoria Cross holder, General Jackie Smyth. And we were busily training to go to the desert, western North Africa, with a bit of mountain warfare training, which was presumably aimed at Karen and Eritrea and that area. In the middle of this,